Before we get started with today's show, I wanted to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, Fantasy Focus Football. They tape every Monday through Friday live on Twitter. Be sure to check it out if you're interested in the very best analysis in the game, or if you're just ashamed of how you did last year in your own league. You can download and subscribe to Fantasy Focus Football now, as well as the right time, wherever you get your podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we're going to talk about the craziest college football story that nobody seems to be talking about. Also, an NFL story I feel like people should be talking a little bit more about. But first... Hey, man, I need somebody to explain to me why it is that Odell Beckham makes y'all lose your damn minds. All right, so Beckham tore his ACL on Sunday when the Browns were playing against the Bengals. After he went out, Baker Mayfield went on a stretch where he had over 20 completions in a row. It was the best that he has looked in the NFL after he shook off his 0-for-5 start with an interception. Good for him, by the way, right? Good for him that he had a game where he looked like the number one overall pick. It's been a while since he looked like the number one overall pick. But because people struggle with the difference between correlation and causation, we immediately had people jump up with the argument that, so was Odell Beckham the problem with the Browns? Right? Like we immediately got to people going to that place. And there's really only one reason that people decided that they wanted to go to that place. It's because they wanted to go to that place. That's it. That's the story that people wanted. And so therefore, they decided to go ahead and ride out with it. Man, we ain't really had a chance to bang on Odell Beckham in a while. Let's go ahead and take this opportunity right now, right? You gotta really want it to try to make the argument that a quarterback is better because he doesn't have one of the best wide receivers in the NFL out there playing with him, right? Like, even if you think that was the case for a game, I personally would like to get a few more data points in before I decided to lean in on something that obviously didn't make sense, right? Because when I hear people make this argument that the Browns are better without Odell Beckham, or that Baker is better without Odell Beckham, one thing I hear in that is, man, people really want this Baker Mayfield thing to happen. Like, they badly want this Baker Mayfield thing to happen. And so you have to come up with an explanation as to why it is this Baker Mayfield thing isn't happening or has not happened. And so what's the easiest person or the easiest thing for you to decide to go blame? We're going to go blame old flashy Odell Beckham. That's the direction it goes in. Gabe, I was getting ready to do this podcast. I was watching Get Up. And it was kind of interesting because it was Dan Graziano, it was Marcus Spears, it was Jeff Saturday, and it was Greg McElroy. And Greg McElroy was all day long on the, it's Odell's fault, right? Like that was just his whole thing. It's because when Odell's in the game, Baker has to think so much about throwing him the ball because he's worried that Odell is going to come on the sideline and pitch a fit if he does not get the ball. I ask this as a serious question. This is Beckham's 7th year in the league. We've seen him throw tantrums, right? And you've heard me talk about it. I ain't really here for grown men acting like children, right? We've seen him throw tantrums. Have we seen him throw tantrums because he wasn't getting the ball? Like, I can't think of that. Now, one thing to understand also, and what makes that very interesting to me, that I can't think of the time that he's throwing tantrums for not getting the ball. Just about every single great wide receiver there's ever been has been good to throw tantrums about the fact that they're not getting the ball. Jerry Rice was good to throw tantrums because he was not getting the ball. Like, Jerry Rice is your ultimate, I like a guy who just puts his head down and plays. When Jerry Rice wasn't getting the ball, when it went from Montana to Steve Young, and Jerry Rice early in that didn't feel like he was getting the ball, we heard from Jerry Rice about the fact that he was not getting the ball. Because we have to remember this about great wide receivers. They're the only great players in football who are dependent upon somebody else to put them in a position to do great things. somebody has to throw you the ball. Like, you know, whatever the rationale is on a given play or a series of plays for not throwing the ball, whatever. I imagine it could be hard to talk to a wide receiver about why it is that he's not getting the ball, especially if he feels like he is open. And with the great ones, they're open even when they're not open.
And the thing about it is, too, if someone was even going to try and come back and make that sort of comparison with a running back, there's a running back. That running back is going to get a certain number of carries right. to be able to make it. But that's divided up maybe against the starter and then some for the backup.
Right.
With a wide receiver, your number of receptions are getting divided by four, probably. Yes.
Then you got running backs. You know, there's all kinds of people that could be also getting the ball here. This is my thing, okay? I watched Deshaun Watson as a younger quarterback. He's still a young one, obviously, but Deshaun Watson as a younger quarterback. And the thing I gave him all the credit for in the world is he wasn't out here trying to make football too complex. He's like, I got the cheat code over there wearing number 10. All right? I think I'll just throw the ball to him if I don't really know what else to do under these circumstances. I'll throw the ball to DeAndre Hopkins. Like, again, can you name a time that you've thought about it with a young quarterback that somebody has come under the impression that, you know, it's probably not good to have one of the best wide receivers that's there? Now, the argument that people have tried to make is when Odell is in the game, then Baker just focuses too much on him. And since he focuses too much on him, he can't get the ball to other people and the offense doesn't go in a certain direction. I don't know about you guys, but that sounds like a Baker Mayfield problem, right? Like, if you can't do the math on what to do with Odell Beckham while also keeping in mind everything else that is on the field, that sounds like a Baker Mayfield problem. I saw something, I forget who it was that was going through the film, that was saying that in that game against the Bengals, it wasn't a whole lot of going to the second read, let alone the third from Mayfield. And this is, what, his third year in the league? Like, this is something that he should be able to do at this point, one would think, or at least I would think that at this point, this would be something that he should be able to do. To me, the biggest problem that Baker Mayfield has is that he can't handle pressure. And so that gets us to a combination of factors that seems to spell out doom. He's not tall. He's not athletic. And he doesn't handle pressure well. So when the pressure comes, what is that guy supposed to do? What I've seen from him in the last season and change when that happens is he runs backwards. Right? Like, you just got to be real about this. That dude just isn't that good. Right? And I've asked this question before. Other than a couple of those throws against the Bengals, like that throw for the winning touchdown was a great throw. Great, great, great throw. Right? It looked like some of the accuracy that we had seen from Mayfield in college. That was really the reason why he got taken number one overall. When does he look like a number one overall pick? Like, when you've seen him play in the last year and change. So, like, for example, you guys know I'm hard on Josh Allen. But one thing I always said about Josh Allen was, oh, but that's a first-round pick. Like, and there was never a point in watching him where I did not understand why it is that somebody would take him with the first-round pick. Like, I mean, I had some questions about whether you should do it, but I understood why somebody would take him with the first-round pick. And you watch him play, like, the physical talent and everything else, it jumps off the screen. When's the last time, except for maybe this last game, that you watched Baker Mayfield and you were like, yo, that dude right there, that's the number one overall pick. Like, all the flaws that Josh Allen has, if you looked at him and said, yo, they took that guy with the first overall pick, I totally would understand why it is that somebody wound up making that decision. Mayfield, thus far, has not been that dude. And now, all of a sudden, he goes out here and lights up the Bengals, and finally, people are so excited. Like, Gabe, we talked about this for years. It was before I met you, but you'll know what I'm talking about with Cam Newton. Where it didn't matter what level of success Cam Newton put up. Once he gave people some reason, any reason, little bitty reason, whatever it was, to be like, see, I told you he wasn't good. You see people do that with Lamar Jackson when he has struggled in different games, right? Like, see, I told you this thing wasn't going to work. Like, you see that come up all over the place. With Mayfield, it goes in the complete opposite direction. Complete. And so for me, it's about body of work. Like, that's what it comes down to. And so for Lamar has a strong enough body of work that a bad game, even if it's against a good team, is not really changing my mind about what I think he's going to be. With Mayfield, a good game, even against a bad team, that's not doing it for me. That's not flipping it up. But I'm not invested in saying that Baker Mayfield is good. I just don't feel like your investment in saying that Baker Mayfield is good should be so strong that you basically out here lying about Odell, man. Spears is about to lose his damn mind on television listening to that. And one thing that I found to be interesting, like this was the most interesting thing about that segment on Get Up. And if you can find it online, check it out, and I think you'll see what I'm talking about. So McElroy is going on and on and on just about, you know, you got to manage Odell and worry about whether Odell's going to lose it on the sideline if he doesn't get the ball and all this. And again, I have not seen that from Beckham in his career, right? He did that in that interview about Eli, but I have not seen, like, we haven't seen a T.O. situation from him. We haven't seen a Chris Carter situation from him. Like, I personally have not seen that. And honestly, the modern generation of wide receivers, we don't hear nearly as much about them behaving like that as we did the guys previous. For whatever it's worth. Like, when you really stop and think about it, we don't have, like, a brat in that way. Like, Beckham has become the defining sort of, you know, the flashy wide receiver who has, you know, he don't always know how to act. Like, I ain't pretending like I don't get that. But still, not in line with what we have talked about in the last 15 or 20 years when it comes to wide receivers. But as McElroy is saying that, Graziano's there. And Graziano, you know, he works up here, right? So he's been around the Giants a lot. He almost whispered it and was like, that's not really true about Odell. He ain't want to stand in it and say it, you know? He's like, that's not really the case. And nobody, like, was like, hold on, Dan, why don't you go ahead and say that again, right? Like, nobody was really invested in that part of the discussion, right? Like, we just made that decision. This is what it is. And one thing I also found funny, too, because stats in football are tricky to use because so few counting stats are really, like, that illustrative as to what you need to know. And so you may have seen this, Gabe, that people are putting up stats about how Baker is better with Odell off the field. And they'll say that his quarterback rating, the old school quarterback rating, is higher with Odell off the field. I think I saw something saying his completion percentage was higher with Odell off the field. But what was interesting on Get Up, they put two stats. I think those are the two stats they put up top. But the one below it was QBR, which is total quarterback rating, which is a proprietary statistic that ESPN has derived that everybody here is very, very proud of in their development because they've done all kinds of things with it. I don't fully understand it, so I don't use it so religiously. But like some of the things they do with that stat, though, is what you do on the field is weighted based on the situation in the game. So you're not going to light it up late in the game down by three touchdowns and really affect that metric. You see what I mean? Like, it does those kinds of things. Running is involved in it. They put winning on it, if I'm not mistaken, as part of it. And that, you know, that's where this gets to be a little bit tricky for me. But this is a stat this company is very, very proud of and really believes that it is the best measurement of quarterback success that you can come up with. Aaron Schatz of Football Outsiders, whose work you guys know I'm a big fan of. He was involved in creating that stat. And I've heard him say that he believes that it is the best stat for measuring quarterbacks. Mayfield, higher QBR with Odell on the field than with Odell off the field. But you ain't about to hear them mention that point, right? Because there is an investment and an easy storyline in the idea that Odell Beckham is somehow a problem or somehow the problem with the Cleveland Browns. I am willing to entertain the idea that maybe that'll bear out, right? Like that maybe we'll get more data, maybe we'll get more evidence, and maybe that'll ultimately prove to be the truth. I don't see no reason to think that. I'm just not the guy that believes that having less money is better than having more. Can't see it. You're just not going to bring me to that place. That's where people stand, and it is just where they want to. And so I want to run something by you that I have thought about for a while, not so much with relation to Odell Beckham, but some of y'all who go back with me will know that I've talked about this with Randy Moss. Standard football analysis of Randy Moss tends to view him through the lens of a malcontent, right? Guy don't want to work hard, that kind of stuff, which is obviously not true about him, right? Guy don't want to work hard. I mean, we can go through a whole list of them, but you know how people talk about Randy Moss. And again, Randy Moss has certainly had his moments of petulance in the NFL. There's no way around that. But what I used to say, and I actually think is one of the more profound things I have ever offered in sports analysis, and I'm going to give it to you now with relation to Odell Beckham, is that rather than look at Randy Moss through the lens of the malcontent, what if you view him through the lens of the prodigy? All right? So think about this, for example. Tom Brady is not a prodigy. but we view Tom Brady through the lens of the grinder, right? Through the lens of the guy that gets all the little bitty details right. And since he gets all the little bitty details right, he then expects everybody else to get all the details right. And when they don't get the details right, he come over the sidelines and he hollers at them, right? And this is treated as defensible behavior. And the argument that they make is he can do that because he is Tom Brady. I understand that, right? Because the truth is, whether you can get away with that, we don't determine this on our microphones. We don't determine this in front of our cameras. That is determined by the people he's screaming at. They're the ones that decide whether or not he can get away with it. But those of us with the microphones, we find it okay because he is Tom Brady. He is so demanding, so forth and so on. All right. So when I was in my early teenage years, my parents got the bright idea like, yo, you know, the boy ain't that happy. Maybe he should go see a therapist, right? One of the greatest things that ever happened to me in my life, right? It worked out. But I remember one of the things, the first things that the therapist wanted me to do was to watch Amadeus, which up until that point, I had not seen. And I remember watching it, and I do remember seeing that, you know, because look, me being who I am, people have considered me to be a different kind of smart for my whole life. Like, people have viewed me through the lens of the prodigy, kind of, sort of, my whole life. But I remember watching Amadeus and thinking to myself, yeah, I don't want to be that, right? Like that dude's get down and everybody around him and everything else. Like, nah, I don't really want to be that. Like, there were certain elements to, like, his talent and how that manifested itself that I was able to relate to. But I was like, nah, I don't really want to be that. But if you have seen Amadeus, think about Randy Moss. And then think about that movie. Like, Randy Moss as he played. Like, it's got to be crazy wild frustrating to be so good at this thing that's harder for everybody else in the world. And it's just easy to you. Just easy as all get out to you. I bet you get bored every now and then when it's that easy to you. I bet you get frustrated every now and then if you're running down the field and for whatever reason the dude can't get the ball to you and you're doing everything it is that you were supposed to do. Like, that's the thing that people understand with Tom Brady, right? And Tom Brady has thought about all these things. His brain's like a computer and he throws the ball to a spot, except somebody ran the wrong route and now it's getting intercepted. And you're just like, yo, how frustrating must it be if you know everything that's supposed to be done and then people don't do what they're supposed to do? How frustrating does it have to be when you're a guy like Moss or a guy like Beckham who is that good at all these things, but the other kids just aren't as good as you? You know? Like, LeBron, I saw a very interesting thing. I think J.R. Smith was talking about this once, where he's talking about, like, watching LeBron as a father. And he said he once was there at the pool, and Bronny was doing backflips into the pool. And that LeBron went and grabbed him and was like, hey, Bronny, come here. He's like, yo, you can't do that. He's like, why? He's like, because these other kids can't do that. And they're going to get out here and try to do that and hurt themselves. So, like, you can't do that. Like, it's a different game when you're the prodigy. All of these things are different. Like, one of the amazing things about LeBron as the prodigy is his ability to, like, get everybody on board and to have what is a certain measure of patience for the fact that these other dudes just aren't as good as him. And so I look at a dude like Beckham. If you view him in the context of the prodigy, right, like, he probably throws a football better than Baker Mayfield does. You've seen those clips of Beckham like kicking the ball before games and stuff like that. I bet you if Odell Beckham played baseball, he would be Mookie Betts. Like, he's just one of these dudes. He's good at everything. He is a star in a different way. He is rare. There are very few people as overall talented as he is. Then you add to that, you know, the ladies think he's highly attractive and everything else. You know, like, this dude's winning in every way except for the fact that he plays for the Browns or except for the fact that he played with Eli Manning, right? Like, the losing for him tends to come up when he's got to depend on these other cats. It doesn't go as well. That's not the easiest thing in the world to deal with, I would imagine, if you're a dude like Beckham. And so it plays itself out in some ridiculous ways. He's gotten better over the years, obviously. We haven't seen him fight a kicking net lately. We haven't seen anything since the Josh Norman thing that was like the Josh Norman thing. And even that was a bit of a special situation because they was working him, right? Like, we haven't seen anything like that from him. We saw him last week, or the week before, I mean, you know, the game before he got hurt. We saw him on the sidelines when they were down against the Steelers trying to rally the troops while Baker Mayfield is over there to the side, like nodding his head because Baker Mayfield ain't leading nothing. Like, that's my thing. If your argument is, well, Baker's got to throw the ball to Odell so he don't lose his mind. If Baker's what y'all say he is, then he's supposed to be in charge and just be like, yo, we going to run this offense and we going to get it done. Because think about this. If you're not throwing the ball to Odell, who you going to throw it to? Jarvis Landry, Odell's best friend, the dude that he wanted to come up there and play with. The need to hammer this dude just seems like people do without a reflex. Like, it just seems like something that people think that they're supposed to do because he fits a template of what they think the guy that they're supposed to beat down in these times. That's how you're supposed to play it. Nah, man. No. If your quarterback can't figure out how to balance having a cheat code with running an offense, your quarterback isn't good, right? If you that excited about beating the Bengals, you got your own problem, you know? But I really think that if you stop and look at Beckham through the context of a prodigy, rather than the easy default, malcontent, spoiled, everything else, I bet you start looking at everything that happens with him a different way. So I remember Jeff Schwartz, if you're familiar with Jeff. Jeff's a former NFL player, does a lot of media stuff now. And Jeff played with the Giants, with Odell Beckham. And I asked him about Odell once, because I've been fascinated by Odell for a long time. I asked him about Odell once, and he was like, yo, I love the dude. Because his big thing was, he's like, dude, nobody's working harder than Odell is. Like, he's putting in all the grind. He's doing all the football stuff that you asked for. He's not Antonio Brown. Right? Okay, sorry. Remember I said we don't really have wide receivers like we had? Forgot about Antonio. Tampa Bay Buccaneer Antonio Brown. Wow. I forgot about that. But that's not what Beckham is. That's not where it comes. But at some point, when you're watching all this football, we're going to have to get back to something I've been talking about for a long time. Well, not really that long, but I've been talking about it on here. Mike Ryan, who produces Dan's radio show, he did not like when I made this point where I was like, look, man, the star white quarterback of the NFL is becoming a bit of an endangered species. And I don't know why this made him so mad, because look around you. Look at the league, right? Or the best way that I put it is, I typically take this back to 2010, but we can really, I think, take this back to 2006 if we so decide. 2005 is the year Aaron Rodgers came in the league. 2004 is the year Eli Manning, Phillip Rivers, and Ben Roethlisberger came into the league. But from 2006 until now, of the quarterbacks still in the league, who are like the really good white dudes?
Matt Stafford.
I feel like we're stretching to have to add him into that, right?
He's played at star level before.
Yeah, he is a good quarterback, right? I think that, like, I'm definitely not going to, like, Matt Ryan is a good quarterback. I would not say that either of them, other than that Matt Ryan MVP year, have really ever been great. I think that's fair. And even with Matt Ryan being great, that was more about the greatness of Kyle Shanahan, one would argue, than I would say it was about the greatness of Matt Ryan, because you see what happened as soon as Kyle Shanahan got out of there, right? All right. So we got those two, and Joe Flacco won a Super Bowl, but none of us have ever thought that Joe Flacco was great. He had the best month of his life at the right time. Now, let's go from 2010 until now. Who you got? Given that Andrew Luck is no longer in the league. And for what it's worth, Andrew Luck got to very good, but Andrew Luck didn't get to great. Like, it might have happened at some point, but I don't think it's fair to say that Andrew Luck got to the point of greatness. So, who is it? From 2010 until now, the best white quarterback that was drafted in that time period that's still in the league is Ryan Tannehill. And it just came back around. Right? So, I was on the phone with Mike about this, and he's starting to go through the guys, and he's like, well, you know, I guess it, you know, depends on what you think about Jared Goff. Did you watch Jared Goff play last night? Like, this is the guy that we're trying to work into the conversation? Is Jared Goff? And look, I'm not saying that there's something innate about white dudes that makes it that they're not, you know, that they can't do this. Like, I'm not making the argument that they're not athletic enough to play in the NFL anymore, because I haven't studied this enough to get you an answer, right? I'm just telling you, from what we've seen, you know what I mean? Like, what is directly in front of us? So let's think about some of the black quarterbacks that have come into the league in the same time period, all right? Cam Newton. Russell Wilson, Deshaun Watson, Patrick Mahomes, Lamar Jackson. Dak Prescott. That is a Super Bowl champion who might win an MVP this year. That is two other guys who have won MVPs this year. And then we start talking about Deshaun Watson and Dak Prescott. Oh, sorry, that's three guys that have won MVPs because Cam Newton. Right? I don't know why this is the case, but we all remember the 2011 draft. They had the nerve to put Cam Newton on the cover of Sports Illustrated with Jake Locker and Blaine Gabbert saying what a difficult choice it was about who to take with the first overall pick. My point simply being, folks will try as hard as they can to hype up whatever the new, maybe good one day white quarterback is going to be. You see it happening up there with Buffalo. I ain't never seen a situation where a team and a fan base has been more insistent upon ignoring someone's glaring flaws and try to pretend like everybody does that stuff than we have with Josh Allen. And it ain't long after, it slowed down now because more time has passed, but it wasn't long before you started saying something bad about Josh Allen before the response was, well, what do you think we should do? You think we should stick with Tyrod? Like the nicest guy in the world who got you to the playoffs for the first time in almost 20 years. It goes right back to Tyrod just about every single time when they get to talking about Josh Allen. And we in a similar place with Baker Mayfield, right? Like one thing I'll give it to the fans in Philly about, they ain't here for the bullshit when it come to Carson Wentz. When Carson Wentz ain't getting it done, they out here saying Carson Wentz ain't getting it done. They don't have time to be out here worried about little things like loving the white man. No. They mo about their business over there in those places. But I think a big part of what goes on with Mayfield, and I don't even think that people realize they're doing it, to be fair. Like, I don't think that people are waking up being like, hey, let's go find a white dude to prop up. I don't think they're doing it. If you out here truly convincing yourself that somehow a team is going to be better for not having Odell Beckham, you just wishing for it. And it's worth asking yourself, why are you wishing for that? All right, I want to read you something that was reported by ESPN, and I understand in part why it's not a bigger story, but I feel like it should be a bigger story. And Adam Schefter reported this on Sunday, and I'm going to read this to you word for word. While most NFL players have recovered quickly from COVID-19, Jacksonville Jaguars running back Wyquell Armstead has not. Armstead, who some within the Jacksonville organization thought would replace Leonard Fournette as the starting running back, is not expected to play again this season because of symptoms that he has suffered while battling COVID-19, league sources told ESPN. Armstead has been hospitalized twice and has suffered from a variety of complications connected to the virus, including significant respiratory issues, and has been hit harder than some expected. Hospitalized twice, and they finally said, nah, we don't think the dude's going to play this year. All right? So here's something that's going on these days, man. People are testing positive for COVID-19. They don't test positive anymore. They then come play football. We act like that's the end of the story. We saw in the NBA bubble, Russell Westbrook didn't play particularly well in that bubble. What happened to Russell Westbrook before he got in that bubble? Russell Westbrook had COVID-19. Last week, on this show, Kendrick Nunn, another guy from Miami, they talked about that with him, that he came around a little later, but coming back from COVID, like, was a monster for him. And to a stretch where he wasn't even really playing very much after playing most of the season. Remember, Gabe, we talked last week about this story, and I had somebody accuse me of, like, being alarmist or fear-mongering, but I'm just telling you things that I don't think y'all are hearing. I told y'all guys about this story in the New York Times about people, like, catching COVID and feeling like they had dementia. Suffering from brain fog, right? Just like they're not there. Like can't remember stuff, like all kinds of things, right? There's a lot that goes on with this virus. And one thing that we haven't been doing in terms of reporting on it or talking about it, this is in sports and other places. I feel like we read a lot of stories about regular people, for lack of a better term, and some of the negative effects of COVID. that they deal with. I don't feel like we read a lot of stories about famous people and the negative things that happen with them, which is interesting because, as you recall, when this thing first started sweeping the nation, it was Tom Hanks getting it when people were like, oh, man, I think I need to start paying attention to this, right? Like, you started having a few people that you'd heard of that said that they had contracted the virus. But we didn't really hear anything about it after that. We see, like, whenever somebody says that they have it and they're famous, the one thing they go out of their way to tell everybody is, hey, I'm okay, which is kind of an understandable thing. And I think that most people do under similar circumstances is you let everybody know, hey, don't worry about it, though. I'm all right. I'm straight, you know. But what does straight mean with this virus? Like, where does it go? What does it mean? And so we hear like, oh, man, you lose your sense of taste or you might lose your sense of smell, which seems like an inconvenience. But what it is something that you can ultimately push through. And what it sounds to me is happening with a lot of guys in football is these dudes are doing worse than we think. And we're not going to know why some of them are doing badly. But once these dudes test positive for COVID, we're snapping back into our football mind, basically. Like, oh, okay, they said you had a high ankle sprain, but you're playing now? Okay, well, all that matters is that you said you can play. That's what we're doing. So I give you two guys to think about with regards to their performance this season. One of them is Ezekiel Elliott, and the other one is Cam Newton, right? And when it really hit me with Ezekiel Elliott, did you see in the game they played against the team? He was supposed to pick up a blitz. It's like he didn't even know that that was part of the play. Like, he comes in late on it and he just got trucked. One of the big things that people talked about Zeke when he came into the league, and one of the reasons why you could take him as a running back with the fourth overall pick, was he was already ready to walk in the door and pass block, which is something that running backs typically are not ready to do, is just come in here and pass block. He was ready to pass block right away. And I watched that dude just get trucked like he didn't even know the play had started. Here's another thing about Ezekiel Elliott. Now, he has had ball control issues, honestly, for most of his career. It's kind of been underplayed about him that he is a bit of a fumbler. But as a fumbler, all right, his first year in the league, he fumbled 5 times. Second year, I think that was the suspension year, he fumbled once in 10 games. The next year, he fumbled 6 times in 15 games. Last year, he fumbled 3 times in 16 games. They've played 7 games this year. He's fumbled 5 times. Like, that's a hell of a spike. And so I look at that, and then I look at what I saw in that pass block play. It's almost like we're talking about a dude that ain't all the way there. Like, the attention to detail is not so much there. Now let's look at Cam Newton. And the tricky thing with Cam is he's so dinged up, right? Is it the foot? Is it the shoulder? So forth and so on. But what I've seen from him that's thrown me off is the processing speed seems to be down. You know, like, Cam has never been a dude that you're going to expect to hit everybody like fresh out of their break, you know, throwing the ball before they've even gone, you know, made the move or whatever it is. That hadn't really been the guy that he's been. And again, he's always had mechanics that relied so much on his physical gifts, that losing the shoulder a little bit, losing the foot a little bit, like, all those things can matter. But he also was just looked like kind of out of it when he's been out there. Now, is the reason that these two dudes seem kind of out of it because of COVID? I can't answer that. I don't know that, you know? So I want to be clear that I'm not saying I know magically what it is. But it's possible. And there's a chance that it's a whole lot of dudes that we're going to be looking at that are struggling with dealing with COVID. And we just don't know because they say, okay, cool, you can play again. Like, think about it. We're talking about this dude for the Jaguars been to the hospital 2 times. And we had no idea. Like, I think a lot of us believe, like, we hear the stories about people being hospitalized and being put on ventilators and stuff like that. But we feel like they go to the hospital and then they get out and then you just shake it off, you know, because you got so many people who be like, well, I had it. It was just like a mild cold or so forth and so on. I mean, maybe for you. But for some people, this thing is real. And it's real in a way that they're not going to talk about. Athletes in general, football players in specific, if they can go, they're going to say they can go. And if they're out there, it ain't going to be no excuses. Think about it, man. Most of my life, dudes were out there playing with concussions and not making excuses. Like getting concussed and playing in the same game, can't remember nothing, seeing two and three of stuff and everything else, because that's what football is. That's what football tells you to do, just get back out there and grind. We got a lot of dudes that's going to be out here just grinding. We got college players that's going to wind up in these same situations, you know? And we just all so thirsty for football that we don't want to think about this stuff, so we've just decided we're just not going to discuss it. Like, Gabe, you sent me a link, what was this, in Connecticut, where they shut down public school football, and so people did, like, well, fine then, we'll start a private football league. And I'm just telling you now, man, there's cost to this, and a lot of dudes who are playing are paying the cost, and you just don't know it. And the reason you don't know it is they know you don't want to hear about it. But I do feel like somebody kind of needs to talk about it, because, like, this is where we are, and this is not... Dude, I was so stunned when they're like, granted, I was not familiar with the player, but when they're like, yeah, he's been in the hospital twice. And I also think that part of why people are going to bring this sort of stuff up is because, like, there's a stigma for people. People are afraid to say that they have had it because, A, they don't want to look like they've been irresponsible, and, B, they don't want to look like they got the cooties. You know, like those things are coming up. Those things are happening. But we got cases rising to the highest levels that we have seen, and we're kind of sort of acting like this isn't happening. It's happening, man. It's happening right in front of your eyes. It's just a matter of whether somebody's going to point it out to you. Well, Gabe, I think that we are dealing with the Odell Beckham episode. This part was kind of accidental, but this story I'm talking about here, this ain't my fault, man. I don't know if this is like a combination of like search engine optimization getting us to where we are or whatever it is. But you hear this story about LSU getting on probation or self-reporting some violations and then self-imposing some penalties. And the story's all led with Beckham is banned from the LSU football program for 2 years because his dumbass was out there handing out bills on the field.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not that they just led with that. They also led with videos and photos of Odell with cash in hand dapping folks up.
Yes, and don't get me wrong, that was wildly stupid. It was wildly arrogant. And don't forget, he was blasted too. But you remember he smacked a cop on the booty and then they tried to like take him to jail and all of that. Like all of that came out of that. And I'm just like, oh, come on, guys. Come on, guys. But the reason I bring this thing up about LSU self-reporting the penalties and how Odell has led the story. So like I just pulled up the Sports Illustrated story with Ross Dellinger and Pat 40. And if I'm not mistaken, they're the first ones to come out with this. But here's how the piece reads. LSU is self-imposing penalties for rules violations and hoping the NCAA doesn't levy more. The school is docking itself 8 scholarships over a 2-year period and reducing recruiting visits, evaluations, and communication after a nearly 2-year investigation uncovered booster payments to the father of a football player, sources tell Sports Illustrated. The school is banning from its facilities for 2 years ex-LSU receiver and current NFL star Odell Beckham Jr., who distributed $2,000 worth of $100 bills during a wild scene that unfolded on the field following LSU's win over Clemson in the national championship game in the New Orleans Superdome. All right, you notice how they slid in there the thing about uncovered booster payments to the father of a football player? Guys, that's the lead. Now, to be fair, in this rendering for Sports Illustrated, they put that ahead in the story. It just wound up not being in the headline. Let me explain to you what they're talking about when they say that a former player's parents receive payments from a booster. Here's what happened. The father of former offensive lineman Vidal Alexander received $180,000 in stolen money from LSU booster John Paul Funes, I don't know how you pronounce that, who admitted in 2019 that he embezzled more than $500,000 from Our Lady of the Lake Hospital in Baton Rouge. The money was payment from 2012 to 2017 for what the NCAA characterized as, quote, a no-show job. Gabe, the man was paying the dude's father with money he was stealing from a hospital. And hold on, I want to make sure I get this part right because I believe it's clear. Okay, it's just a regular hospital. I thought it was a children's hospital. Anyway, either way it goes, this dude was stealing money from a hospital and using it to pay the parents of recruits, of a player. All right? I do have judgment about the stealing from the hospital part. You know I don't really have much judgment on the paying player situation. That's not, you know, that ain't really my bag. Stealing from a hospital, I think we can all agree. That's bad form. Right? That's bad form. However, when I was a kid, that would lead the news. Right? Now, I'm okay with it not leading the news because we don't want to lean in on the idea that people getting paid is scandalous. But that's how I feel. There ain't really been that much a change in the consensus of media or anything else about whether or not they think cheating is okay. No matter what the rules happen to be, right? Cheating is cheating, and people generally have a problem with cheating. And is there anything more college football and more Louisiana than stealing from a hospital to pay an offensive lineman that I personally had never heard of? Right? Like this ain't, like this buddy wasn't going to Odell Beckham. This money wasn't going to Joe Burrow. You know, this wasn't going to Clyde Edwards-Helaire. This is going to some dude. Some dude. This is so Louisiana and so hilariously SEC and everything else. But they going to lead off with it, talking about Odell Beckham handing out the bills in the locker room. Somebody daddy got $180,000, which, by the way, is the alleged price to get Cam Newton to Auburn. It was $180,000. So a lot of this, look, that was 10 years ago, right? A lot of this has changed a lot, and I just think that people aren't on the NCAA side like that. I think that's part of it. I also think that another part of it is people figured out that the more they scandalize these payments and things like that, the more momentum goes on the side of those who advocate for paying the players. Like when the stories become a big deal about the dudes getting money, that galvanizes the folks that think they should be paid. And then all of a sudden you get more and more discussion on it. Like I think the media is disproportionately in favor of players getting paid. And like the sample that is the media is more in favor of players getting paid, I think, than the sample that is the college football audience. You know, and like we're now at a point where it's kind of a 50-50 situation. But historically, the public has been opposed to players getting paid. Like that's just kind of been what it was. And so I just feel like the way they do this is let's put Beckham up front. People love to talk about that. Let's ignore this other part. Because if it gets to this other part, now people are going to, again, it makes a thing that they don't necessarily want to be a thing. But me and Spencer were talking about this the other day on the phone, man. The biggest reason we can't quit this is the absurdity. The biggest reason we can't quit college football is that people steal from hospitals to pay players that you may have never even heard of. It's part of the charm of the situation. It's part of what makes it hilarious. It really, really is, right? We can't even talk about the fun stuff no more because y'all want to come out here and talk about Odell. We already talked about that. We talked about that too damn much when it happened, right? You kidding me? And LSU sacrificed him up, right? They will ban him for 2 years. And the NCAA might look at that as, hey, good job. Who knows? There's no telling. Because the last thing the NCAA wants to do is put LSU on real probation. They don't want no parts of putting LSU on no real probation. That's bad for business. Like, you don't remember this, Gabe, but when I was a kid, the NCAA used to take teams off of television. Like, they would be like, all right, Texas A&M, you got in trouble? Okay, cool, you're off TV for a year. Until they realized that just costs everybody money. They quit that. They did that death penalty thing one time. It was too damn effective. They never do that again. Mm-mm. They're like, yo, we got to punish people, but, you know, let's not be stupid about this. Anyway, I just don't want to get to a point where the absurd things happen in college football and we just ain't going to talk about them because it makes people look bad. No. It makes college football look very, very interesting. And quite honestly, that's the reason most of us are here.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, our first is an international story.
This is Alex Ward from Vox. In Nigeria right now, there's a massive social media movement called NSARS. And SAR stands for the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, which is a federal police unit in Nigeria that was formed in 1984 to thwart crime, robberies, kidnappings, carjackings. And that's because in the 80s and 90s, that type of crime rose quite greatly in Nigeria. But what happened is that unit has started to harass the Nigerian people by basically going up to them and taking their money, and worse, torturing them, killing them extrajudiciously, and more. It has been the focal point now of Nigerian anger for years, especially since 2017, since the Nigerian people feel this police unit and the Nigerian government writ large no longer care for their safety, that they are hurting the people they've sworn to protect. So this social media movement is trying to bring awareness around the violations by this police unit and also the violations of the government. However, there has been a deadly standoff where government forces have killed at least 12 protesters, and there has been some looting and some violence. And since the moment of the killings, there's been basically a desire to calm things down and make sure that, you know, everyone that was in the movement, the peaceful protests, can regroup. And what's really happening now is this is all about police brutality, of course, but it's also really about the future of Nigeria. The Nigerian youth especially wants the government to care for them and to provide the right services. And so they're demonstrating on the streets and on social media demanding those rights. The Nigerian government isn't necessarily giving it to them yet, but there are elections coming in 2023. And so the question now is, will the Nigerian youth organize politically and perhaps remove the sclerotic government and those people not caring for them out of power in the coming years?
I wanted to put this in because I myself had been seeing people talk about this, but had not really dived into it to really understand what was going on. So for those of you who don't know what's going on, you know, go ahead and give it a chance to look at it. Now, one thing that was interesting, he mentioned 1984 as a year in Nigeria. I don't think he mentioned something that happened, as I recall, in 1984 in Nigeria, which is that was the institution of military rule was in 1984. And that is now, it is no longer military rule, but like, let's stop and think about this for a second, right? If the military takes over and then they decide to come up with a special crew to go stop these things, what you really think is going on? There was a coup in 1983. And it happened on December 31st. So you feel where I'm coming from here. Once that happens and you decide, the military decides we need another police force, that tells you a whole lot about what you need to know. And it also tells you, and this is very important, it's about power, man. Like police brutality and all of that stuff, this is about power. In America, it manifests itself as race because what power you have in this society can be dictated by what race you are. You know, and so the issues with police brutality when they are about race is rarely about the race of the people inflicting the brutality and almost always about the race of the people under the boot. You know, so yes, black people can also do this to black people, but it really happens to black people a lot more, no matter who the person is swinging the billy club. So I encourage you to check out and see what's going on there. And it seems, and Gabe, you correct me if I'm wrong here, but it also seems in part that a lot of the movements that we've seen in the United States are coming to influence people in other parts of the world. You know, like I feel like a lot of what's happening in the United States is influenced by the Arab Spring of 2009. But I think like on this specific issue, a lot of what's happened in the States and the things that people are talking about, we're seeing this now influence folks in other countries and decide that they're not putting up with this. Like we saw this, you know, with Black Lives Matter in Europe during the summer, you know, in the sports and things like that, right? Like the social movements of this country are influencing the rest of the world, I would argue, in a positive way.
All right, our next story comes from tech.
Hey, my name is Joe Rossignol, and I'm a reporter for an Apple blog called Mac Rumors. So one of the interesting stories that we shared this week was how the iPhone 12 Pro can be used to instantly measure somebody's height using the Measure app. So on the back of the iPhone 12 Pro, there's a new small sensor called the LiDAR scanner. This projects an invisible laser into the surroundings, and this allows you to point your device at somebody, and the lasers basically do a bunch of invisible math and depth depth maps and all this innovative tech stuff to figure out how tall somebody is. And then on the screen, it'll instantly show whether they're 5'9", 6'1", you name it. The story actually went a little bit viral on Twitter over the weekend. A lot of people were using it to make funny jokes about like how you won't be able to lie about your height on Tinder anymore, or husband and wives debating who's taller and finally settling that debate. But all in all, jokes aside, it's just another example of a very innovative tech feature and really proves how immersive tech is becoming in our lives. So this feature, all you have to do is get the new iPhone 12 Pro or iPhone 12 Pro Max next month, or if you have one of the newer iPad Pros that came out this year, and then you just have to open Apple's pre-installed Measure app, hold your device at somebody, and yeah, have some fun with it and see who's really telling the truth about their height after all.
Yo, I just want to know who was sitting around and came up with this idea and thought this is something that anybody needed. I ain't so much worried about this, but I kind of feel bad for all you, hint, hint, wink, wink, 5'9"s out here, right? Like, why somebody need to come tell on you? I just don't see, like, who was sitting up and was like, yo, it'd be really dope if you could just point something at somebody. Does it matter to you how tall somebody is? Like, where in your life does it matter the actual measurement on how tall that person is?
It doesn't. As a guy who's in that 5'9 range, it doesn't until somebody says it. I feel targeted.
Yeah.
People in my height range were always under attack.
Well, it's only going to be used to shame people. That's the whole thing about it. It's only going to be used to shame people. That's it. Although I imagine Pablo going to spend a lot of time being like, hey, do it. Do it. See, I'm 5'10".
Yeah, I mean, and the thing about it, when you put it that way, is it's really gonna expose the pretenders versus the contenders. People like Pablo are gonna be out like, measure me, I dare ya, do it. You know, whereas people like me are going to be like trying to dodge that laser.
Yeah, but see, the problem with like people and with how tall they say they are is, so like I say I'm 6'4". I'm probably closer to 6'3". But part of why I say I'm 6'4" habitually has been my brother always said he's 6'4", and we about the same height. You know what I mean? And so if he's 6'4", did that mean, it's not like I spent every day of my life just walking around with a tape measure. Right? Like, just trying to see how tall I was. Like, that did not happen. And it just dawned on me, this gonna eliminate the notches on the wall. You know, people, they measure their height and it's like a whole thing. Now they're just gonna be keeping it in the phone. In the words of Michael Irvin, we losing the recipes.
I had a Mark McGwire real life Oakland A's height poster, and I could measure myself up to how tall Mark McGwire was.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Like the technology. We don't need this. We don't need this. But I ain't gonna lie. Some of you little fellas, you're gonna be like, damn, Bomani, why you keep pointing your phone at me? Just checking something. Don't worry about that.
Just trying to get peace of mind. That's all.
Yeah, I'm not looking at you. No, I'm just looking at something on the screen.
Well, the thing about it is, too, that Joe said was that the LiDAR scanner, the laser thing, is invisible. So it's not like exactly like some sort of Jedi, like Star Wars thing where you're going to be sitting on one side of the room and you're going to see like blue lights coming out of your phone. You can just kind of passively be like, nah, dude, I'm on IG.
It ain't even about you right now.
All right, our last story comes from business.
This is Lassie Meyer with Fast Company. In the before times when you went out to a restaurant, you tipped your server. What about now? 19% of Americans say they tip less than they did before COVID-19, according to a new Harris poll. How closely diners are clenching their wallets depends on their age. Folks 18 to 44 tip less often than they used to versus people 45 and older. Ultimately, your opinion about tipping depends on whether you're sitting at a table or bringing food to it. Restaurateurs can legally pay waitstaff less than $3 an hour in some states, so those gratuities bring servers up to minimum wage. And during COVID, waiters and waitresses are serving people who've already lowered their masks to eat. A tip used to be for good service, and now it's to reward waitstaff for taking on risk. But some customers dining out during the pandemic view it as a way to support small businesses. A percentage of them may have lost their jobs due to COVID-19, so their personal budgets are tight. To that, servers say, if you can afford to go out to eat, you can afford to tip. Research finds that some tipping is motivated by who sees you do it, like the customers who enjoy the flourish of tipping big in front of the group eating together at one table. But large get-togethers are a no-no during the pandemic. The other big question is about gratuities for carryout. Before COVID, most people didn't tip if they picked up a takeout order from a local restaurant. That seems to be changing now, as more customers would rather bring food home than eat out. In fact, the Harris poll finds that 21% report tipping more often in the COVID era than they used to. Another 40% say their tipping habits haven't changed at all.
If you can't afford to tip, you can't afford to eat. Now, I have always been a person that's big on this. Like, I don't like the idea of tipping as being, like, mandatory in that way. You know what I mean? Like, do your job. Like, if you slacking on doing your job, then you should not get the tip. Otherwise, this whole system doesn't work. Like, one thing I have to say about this, Gabe, you've been to Europe, I've been to Europe, they be taking their pretty time to come do everything for you at a restaurant. I don't know if it's because they pace it slow or because they make that living wage, whatever it is, but there is an incentivizing structure in place where the tip thing is like, yo, come out here and get this going, right? But if you're not doing your job, then I don't feel like I should be obligated to ramp this up. But if your reason for not tipping is I ain't got it right now, then it sounds like you need to go to the grocery store, get you some provisions, come back home and whip up some vittles in this time in particular. You're like, yo, man, you know, my money's a little bit tight right now, but you're paying for food, right? You know, now, if you want to be mad at somebody, be mad at these apps and these ridiculous fees they are charging. You know, and the tips often don't even go to the damn. Now, this may be something that people say is the tips very often don't even go to the damn servers because they got all kinds of math and stuff that they got in place that allow them to scoop up some of the tip money rather than pay it out. Like, if you don't want to pay like 30% when you used to pay 15 or 20, I understand that. But I do not understand it. If your argument is, I just ain't got it right now. You don't deserve to eat out. This is the rule. Like, I remember the first time I went to Magic City and we paid the $10 to get in or $20 to get in. We thought we were in. Cool. And then people came and told us, if y'all ain't gonna spend no money, y'all gotta go. The cover charge does not mean that you just in here all night. That's not really how this works. There's an expectation, it is the custom, that you're gonna spend some other money once you get in there. That's how the game is supposed to go. You know? So, nah. This idea of, you know, I just ain't got it right now, then you ain't got it to eat. Period.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bomani. What gave you the idea for the social segment this week? Are we talking about long lines in terms of the voting situations that initially where the topic came from?
Yeah, no, I went and dropped my ballot off at Madison Square Garden. And yo, like the lines are crazy. Everywhere in New York City, their early voting started on the 24th and people were out. People were there to get it done. People ain't really trusting the mail. I think also people just don't want to be on the streets on election day because there's no telling how it's going to play out and everything else. And so the lines were seen to be peaceful and pretty happy, you know, and all of that stuff. But I know long lines sometimes bring out the worst in people. And so I figured I'd just take a flip off of what was going on and find, hopefully, y'all would help us find the funny.
Ooh, and people did find the funny. Our first comes from Sean in San Jose.
So the story I have, back in 2012, you're a sneakerhead, so you know about the AJ4 white cements. So they came out February. We went to the Foot Locker at the Valley Fair Mall over here. The line was crazy, all the way out to back. Into the parking garage all the way out there. We got there at 5 a.m. Some people were there before that. Thought we were going to get in good position to get these shoes. Clearly, we were not in the first 20. I wear a size 10, which means that size goes out the window immediately. 9 and 10, none. So we get to the front. Our shoes are sold out. Some guy, 5 minutes later, comes out on with a dolly, and he's pulling, must have been, 8 pairs of shoes from that store. Big dude had a couple of people with him. He did not know that there were some trifling looking individuals in the back of this line. And we know he did not make it to his car. And the reason why we know that is because we saw him in the parking garage later on in the mall, hanging out by himself, no shoes, no socks, no boys. And this is the guy that's pushing the dolly out. That's the craziest thing I think I've ever seen waiting in a long line. A dude to just end up with no shoes in the parking lot.
What was he thinking?
Isn't there a limit when you go wait for shoes like that? Like, you can't buy more than a pair or two pairs?
Yeah, normally, I mean, I don't know what it was in 2012. I just don't know why this dude thought he was going to walk around with a hand truck full of shoes and thought it was just going to be, as I explain to people all the time about the shoe line, them folks are not in line so that they can have an opportunity to get some shoes. They are in line to get some shoes. they are going to leave with some shoes, if at all possible.
This is why they made those rules, right?
Yeah, that's why, like, I had been saying this for a while. They just had to stop doing the in-person things, like the long lineup, because Nike wanted to do it so they could have these pictures of these long lines to show the incredible demand, but all it was doing was messing the world up, because again, they're not there to try to get shoes. They're there to get shoes. And once there's a whiff of a chance to get some shoes, it's on and pop.
What does this dude think? He's coming out the store like Willy Wonka?
Right, right. I bet y'all wish y'all was me. I sure do.
All right, this next one, the guy didn't leave his name, but he's calling about a story at FAMU.
Craziest thing I've ever seen in line was when I was an undergrad at Florida A&M University, waiting in financial aid line in the administration building, and I watched a young lady recruit her friends to surround her while she changed clothes because she had an interview later that day and time was getting short.
Yo, not mad at all. Those real friends right there. Not mad at all. I thought that was actually going to go way worse, man. That financial aid line. So, like, I had scholarship and I worked on campus. So, I used to always get my paperwork straight because, like, in this era of all this online stuff, y'all don't know what it's like to be sitting online to register to go to school with your fee sheet and all of that stuff like that. And so, I used to, like, at least go early. I'd go in the line and just go, like, holler at my friends, holler at girls and stuff like that because they wasn't going nowhere and I didn't need to be there. I'd just be in there. But every now and then it hit that moment and it's like, nah, it's getting a little tense in here. It's people been waiting here way too long and they don't hire anybody at financial aid because of their customer service acumen. Oh, no, no, no. It get a little dicey.
This story is operating under the kind of assumption that she would have the clothes that she was changing into, right? So she would be changing at some point that day before she had to go to that interview. Haven't you seen one of those like mobile changing rooms where it's like a little hoop?
Yes, yes. Yeah. No, I think what she did was she probably called the girls and was like, maybe her roommate, like, hey, get my stuff and bring it. I ain't gonna be able to leave here in time. Like, no, that's squad goals right there.
Those are real friends.
Oh, yeah.
All right, this last one comes from a familiar voice, a friendly face, our man Florida James.
What's going on, Bo? I just wanted to share a story with you that actually happened 8 years ago this past weekend. So I'm in Pittsburgh for my birthday with a few homies, and we're there to see a Pittsburgh Steelers and Washington football team game. This is RG3's rookie season, so we're pretty excited. Turned out to be a pretty good weekend. But all in all, the Friday or the Saturday before the game, we decided to step out. And so we stepped out about 11, going into midnight or so, and I'm hungry and want to get a sandwich. So we stopped by a pub so I can get a sandwich. So not everybody's in line necessarily, and a couple of homies standing near the door, everything's chill. I'm standing in line with a homie, and then we got another homie who's off doing his own thing. So next thing you know, hear some rustling in the background, a kerfuffle brewing, if you will. And the next thing you know, here's some people pushing off on each other and then some stuff starts popping off. So me and my boy look back and I'm just hoping that, you know, this doesn't pop off before I get my sandwich. So next thing you know, old boy who was off doing his own thing was literally not reading the room and he finds himself trying to record the fight for WorldStar. So next thing you know, the two women who are getting ready to go at it, they look at him and they're just like, oh, no, Mr. Man, we're not really doing none of that here. We ain't really going to be doing none of that. And so next thing you know, someone else pops off, and then one of the women says, oh, no, we TTG. We train to go. And so they really ready to pop off. Cops come in, de-escalate the situation, thankfully enough. So nothing really came of it, but we had to clear out for a little bit. But I already paid for my sandwich. So I circled back, asked one of the officers if he would be kindly enough to, like, at least help me look out to go see if I can go get my sandwich. Everything dies down, even after it is that someone was talking about going off and popping and something off in the trunk or whatever like that. But thankfully, everything dies down. We skate back off into the crib. I chill. I got my sandwich. And lo and behold, that sandwich was awful. Wasn't worth the trouble. Wasn't worth none of that stuff popping off. And once more, to cap off the night, the futon I was sleeping on that weekend ended up collapsing on me. So that's my story of waiting for something entirely too long for a dry sandwich and a bad futon.
My in-line story is a line I didn't actually get in. So one weekend in Atlanta, it's Labor Day weekend, and one of my partners from California came to kick it, right? We're trying to figure out where we was going to go on Friday night. And so we cruise around town, and we rolled past this one club, and I didn't really know the club, but it was on Peachtree, and it was a line, like, all the way down the block. like way down the block. I'm like, oh, yo, it's cracking in there, right? But I didn't know what it was, so we didn't wind up going. Didn't think nothing of it, man, but it was just like a bunch of dudes lying all the way down. I'm like, okay, they got something going. Who knows, right? And so the next day, we at the mall, we at Lenox, and my man is like, seems to be a lot of the gays out here, right? And like his people are West Indian and all this. And I'm like, I'm not having this, right? I'm like, come on, man. You know, like I don't even know what you're talking about. Like, I don't even notice this, you know, no, like I'm going high horse on it about what I believe to be his intolerance. And then like 3 minutes later, I looked up and it was some dude who rolled up. It's a leather hot pants. And I looked around and I realized, oh, it is Pride this week. And I imagine that you have seen Pride in whatever city you live in. But Pride in Atlanta is a whole different ballgame, baby. It was like all of a sudden it went from black and white to color. Like, I don't know how I didn't notice. But after that, I started looking around and I was like, oh, okay. My bad, dog. I missed something. No, this is different. You are correct. And we started getting looks and the up down and everything else. And then it dawned on me. Oh, that was the gay club last night where the line was. Because people got them stories all the time that they go and they see a club. They don't know what it is. And they get in. Like, there was one club in college. On Fridays, it was the Warehouse. But on Saturday, it was Tracks. And so on Friday, they always had stuff going. They always had promotions. And you go. And then invariably, a Saturday night would come. You and your partners ain't doing nothing. But they're like, oh, well, let's go to the Warehouse. And you go to the Warehouse, but you don't know it's not the Warehouse this night. And they would always tell the story about getting in there and then being like, oh, wait, sorry, my bad. I didn't get it. And the thing they all said was, them dudes was hollering at them. Like, they had never been in a situation where somebody was hollering at them. Like, that's the kind of thing that should have made us all be like, yo, maybe we need to start treating women a little bit differently. Because them dudes was definitely treating you like you was treating them. And they was not prepared. But I was there. There's nothing like, I was like, man, you tripping right now. Then I looked around and was like, oh, no, it's a whole different Saturday at Lenox. No, they ain't nothing shy about it. Like, it's Pride weekend on top of it. Oh, they were showing out.
So it's like what you talked about with L last week. Different nights at different clubs.
That's right. Yes, that was definitely a different day at the mall when we showed up in there. It was just so wild because I don't really pay that much attention to other people. And, you know, you live in Atlanta long enough, like seeing gay dudes walk around. If it was a thing to you when you first got there, it ain't going to be a thing for very long. And so I was really looking at him like, come on, man, you're tripping right now. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, it's 2003. You don't need to be acting like that. Then I looked around and was like, oh, okay, my bad. That's what you was talking about. Got it. And I, to this day, I wonder, like, what if we had gone in that club? What would that, because I have not been in that situation. What would that night have been? And of course, who might you have seen that you did not expect? Except them people would have been saying the same things about us. But ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. Gabe Bassan, Christina Buswell, Tariqa Foster, head of everything behind the scenes. Thank you, guys. Thank you to our If You Haven't Heard contributors. Thanks to Alex Ward of Vox. Check out his story on NSARS in Nigeria. Thanks to Joe Rosenow of MacRumors.com. Check out his story on the iPhone 12, letting you measure somebody's height. And thank you to Zlati Meyer of Fast Company. Check out her story on the ugly truth about tipping waitstaff during COVID-19. Also, get ready. We are doing another baseline series. It's going to be coming to you soon. This time, we are going to talk about the prep-to-pro pipeline in the NBA, what has changed and what is changing. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. We'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.